Insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Captain Bob Wells coming to you live from the luxurious Essential Pest Control Studios located in the KVOI broadcast complex here in Tucson, Arizona. Welcoming you to a special National Security and 9/11 Patriots Week edition of Inside Track. Producer Tom joins us running the board and taking your calls, and we invite your questions or comments for our guest at 520-790-2040, which are relevant to the topics. Bruce, Eb, and I want to remind you to support our great sponsors. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail. Jamie has loads of great steel products at super low prices for your home, office, or ranch. Drop by the yard, which is open Monday through Fridays, 8 to 4:30, and Saturdays, 8 to 1. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is the best place to find things you won't see anywhere else. Call Jamie or Craig at 209-1576. We love Essential Pest Control. Call at 886-3029 and hire Eric Rudin's professional team to use science to keep you safe from bugs, termites, varmints, and even weeds. With temps rising, you need to protect your home or business. Also supporting Inside Track is co-host the aforementioned Mr. Eb Wilkinson. From Wilkinson Wealth Management, Eb is dedicated to help you retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call for Eb at 777-1911. Don't forget that Bruce, Eb, and I support all of our great locally owned family-run businesses who support Inside Track. And so should you. Lastly, but certainly not leastly, I'm very pleased that Bruce's Mercedes SUV is now maintained by our newest sponsor, Perfection Auto Works. Call Mike Emery at 323-8650. He and his great technical team are here to make autos great again. And now for our listeners, we have a very special guest joining us now. I have the pleasure of introducing him to you all, and his name is General Keith Kellogg. General Kellogg is one of the nation's top national security professionals and is here to discuss the ongoing U.S. national security approach to Russia and Ukraine after the Wagner Group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin's demise. So a very good welcome to you, General. Welcome to Inside Track.
Bob, thanks for having me. It's good to be with you today. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's really great to hear your voice again, sir, and again, thanks again for your leadership this last few months focusing on what's happening with Ukraine, what's happening with Russia. And just to set things in context here in our listening area, we've watched Mr. Putin meeting with Kim Jong-un this week, and I know you're watching things from your Washington, D.C. perch. Could you please provide our listeners a sense of where we're at regarding American foreign policy in Russia?
Yeah, you know, Bob, it's really kind of, you know, a little bit complicated. What I mean by complicated, you're looking at something, primarily the Ukraine issue with Russia, that has not really been well defined by this administration. I mean, President Biden has said, well, we're going to be there as long as it takes and do whatever it takes in Ukraine. But he hasn't really explained what the national security vital interests are in Ukraine. I mean, they're fighting exceptionally well. It's become almost a war of attrition and the largest land war in Europe since the end of World War II. And that's a little bit frustrating for somebody like me who really likes to see the issues defined pretty well. What you got with Russia and Ukraine? You know, these are the two largest nations, actually, in geographically speaking, in Europe right now. And Russia wanted it by force of arms to take Ukraine. And Ukraine has fought back exceptionally well. And it has resisted that, and that fight is now kind of stabilized in about a 600-mile range of the eastern part of Ukraine. About 20% of Ukraine that Russia has taken, and Ukraine is fighting to take it back. And the losses have been enormous. I was in Ukraine just about 7 months ago, and we talked to pretty senior officials, and we traveled very far to the east in the Donbass region to actually see some of the commanders that were out there. And people need to understand that the losses they're taking, the Ukrainians and even the Russians, we haven't seen these number of losses since World War II. You're looking at over probably right now in the range of 120,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed, you're looking at probably 200,000 Russian soldiers killed, and you're talking probably around 500,000 killed and wounded on both sides. As a means of departure, understand that in World War II, the United States only lost, killed in action, around 400,000.
Wow.
So the fighting has become something we haven't seen since really World War I, which is into the trenches, trench fighting, an attrition fight going on. And unfortunately, this is going to go on for a while because we've kind of let it go on. We haven't really come up with any idea how to bring this war to an end, which is unfortunate. But looking at that, when you look at it, when I look at what's happening right now with Russia, that's the reason you see him going to Kim Jong-un, going to talk to his allies there in China as well, because they're running out of materiel support. What I mean by materiel support, just as a data point, the Russians right now are pulling T-55 tanks out of mothballs because they've lost so much equipment. Well, the T-55 tank was taken out of the Russian military inventory as a combat vehicle in 1981. And so you're looking at them losing a lot of equipment. They're having to go second, third, fourth-rate equipment. They're down to reserve forces that are fighting as well because their elite forces were fractured. The reason why I'm concerned about Ukraine, because the longer we stay focused in on Ukraine, we are unable to pivot to the Pacific. And to me, the Pacific is the largest threat area that we're going to face in the next one or two decades. And the adversary that we're facing happens to be China. And unfortunately, we don't recognize China as an adversary. We, in fact, talk to in the national security strategy, we talk as China as a competitor. No, France is a competitor. China is an adversary. That doesn't mean an enemy, because if you look at the exact definition of adversary, it's a pretty intense competitor in military and economic and diplomatic terms. But we need to address that as well. And so that's the reason I was talking earlier, Bob, about the entire context of how you have to look at Ukraine. The reason why I think we need to support the Ukrainians, even though it hasn't been well-defined, it should be, is because I've always believed you should never have to fight two enemies at the same time. And taking a strategic adversary off the stage, Russia, is good for the United States to be able to pivot into the Pacific region, which is an area that we're going to have to face in the near term. Now, the problem the Biden administration has is they haven't actually given the vital national interests to the nation, and all this money that we're spending of why we're doing it when our southern border is wide open. So this is, you're going to see this come to a little bit of a head in funding with the Republican House of Representatives and the Democratic Senate-controlled Senate, because there's been competition between both of them, and they're going to have to work this one out. You know, my recommendation is that they ought to probably figure a way how they can basically, cut the baby in half and solve the problem, and they haven't been able to do it. I think what they probably ought to be able to do is in the near term, head towards negotiations of some type and tell both sides, we're going to have to negotiate our way out of this. That's a war's end. And maybe with negotiations, what I mean by that is you tell the Russians, hey, look, you need to pull your forces out of Ukraine. And you tell the Ukrainians, unless you go to negotiations, we're not going to keep supplying you with the equipment that you need to prosecute the war. And actually sit down with an interlocutor, which we don't have, and sit down and talk your way through it. That doesn't mean you stop fighting. Bob, remember the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Just because you began negotiations didn't mean you stopped fighting at all. You kept fighting your way through it. It's not a frozen peace. You can't do that because historically what's happened in Ukraine was called Minsk I and Minsk II. Those were some type of negotiation, but they failed, and you can't afford to have, that thing failing this time around, because then it just goes to a general war, which ought to be everybody's concern. And then the final thing I'll say before I put it back to you is this whole discussion about Ukraine coming into NATO, I think, is flawed. And the reason I think it's flawed is there's too many dangers. You can have bilateral security agreements. You don't need to take them into NATO. If you look at NATO, Article 10 is very clear. For somebody to come into NATO, they must enhance regional security as part of NATO under the NATO treaty. And I think it would be hard-pressed for anybody to tell me bringing Ukraine into NATO at this time enhances the security of NATO. It doesn't. It actually makes it more risky. So I think this is something set for the long term. You can do bilateral agreements, much like we did historically with either South Korea, or we actually did years ago with Taiwan, have some type of bilateral agreement, security agreement, and that will pause the Russians. But somebody's going to have to start negotiating sooner or later, or they just can't continue this war of attrition. Okay, that's a long answer to a pretty short question, but I want to kind of give it a, you know, give it a, the understanding to the people out there what this complicated issue looks like.
That's great context, sir. And again, it is very complex. You really set up a nice, really a triangle, almost a flux capacitor, where you've got Russia, you've got China, and you've got Ukraine, the United States right in the middle with regard to our foreign policy. And to your point about NATO and a different type of a framework, a security framework like we had with Taiwan, you know, we started off with the Partnership for Peace with President Clinton back in 1994. That could be a similar model. But, you know, really back to your point about having to deal with the Russians, how are we dealing with the Russians right now? I mean, how are we diplomatically engaging the Russians? Is the Secretary of State talking to Lavrov? Are we working with the Finnish president? Do you have some insight there, sir? How are we talking with Mr. Putin?
Yeah. You know, that's a great question, because we're not. And one thing I found, if you deal with adversaries, probably the worst thing you can do is not talk to them. That was one thing in the last administration when I was in the White House. Mm-hmm. You know, President Trump would talk to anybody, which was very, very important, because you have to keep those lines of communication open. And what Biden has done is he's actually severed those lines of communication. And the principals have to do the talking. You can have your second, third, or fourth level people doing talking, but it doesn't make it doesn't really make the effort or the issue come to a head. You have to have the presidential authority going forward, the president talking to him. I remember when Trump talked to Putin, he talked to him 17 different times when I was there. Look, that's what Trump did when he went with Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when he first wanted to talk, he meaning Trump, to Kim Jong-un, we all kind of said, oh, this is going to be interesting. And he said, look, you've got to be able to talk to these people. If you don't talk to them, then you don't know what's on their mind, and you kind of talk them off the ledge. And think of it this way. Like right now, just last week, you had Kim Jong-un travel just north of Vladivostok in Russia to meet with Putin. The entire 4 years that the Trump administration was in office, we had those forces separated. We actually had broken them apart, so you didn't have to face them all together as a unified and unitary effort. And the problem now, you've got Russia working with China, and you've got Russia working with China and North Korea, and you've got Russia working with North Korea, China, and Iran, because Iran's supporting them with almost all of the drones that they've got fighting right now against Ukraine. So the problem is, by not talking, it really puts it into a bind. And you can't, and the Finnish, you know, the president can't really talk to Putin now, because now that NATO has accepted, mm-hmm. and Finland has joined NATO, he kind of goes, hey, I don't know if this is where, you know, we want to, you know, be able to talk to him. So it's kind of an issue, the problem they've got right now with this administration by not talking. So it's a long answer to a short question. It's just not working well. And they're going to have to find an interlocutor, somebody able to talk to the Russians and the Ukrainians as well. There's nobody out there right now.
Picking up on your point with regard to the principals in that particular level and your statistics on the loss of life, the tragedy with the Ukrainian side, the Russian side, in terms of their military forces, the civilians whose lives have been destroyed in Ukraine. You have a leader like, Lloyd Austin. You know him very well, Secretary of Defense, and certainly we do have mill-to-mill communications with the Russians and with other parties. We have difficulties even talking with China right now, but would Secretary of Defense Austin be one of the key people that you would like to see engaged with the Russian, their counterparts, since the Russians seem to have gotten a very difficult report, Russian military commanders complaining of their difficulties, the effectiveness of the Ukrainian force objectives, the loss of their air defenses there. Do you see somebody like SecDef Austin being able to engage with his counterparts, sir?
No, I don't, Bob, and here's why. You know, Austin has been snubbed by some people. Like, for example, he was snubbed by Lee, the Chinese Secretary of Defense, who's gone missing
He's gone missing,
weeks.
Yes, he's gone missing.
Yeah,
that's a whole show,
yes,
sir.
but the problem you run into having your second through your third Stockton, until they hear from the principal, president to president, mm-hmm. and the president can pick up the phone and talk to Putin anytime he wants. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's not that hard to connect with them. You know, I saw it, as I said before, when I was in the Trump administration, I was on the what's called a drop line. That means you have a phone that you actually listen in on.
Mm-hmm.
They do it the same way, 17 different times. And you have to have that dialogue. And until you have the senior level dialogue doing that, or having somebody that can help you do that, it's going to cause an enormous problem. Look, I thought out of the box. I said, it's not going to happen. But I'm one of those guys who said, well, maybe what you can do is you can actually have somebody like a Trump, if the administration would allow it, because he knows Putin and he knows Zelensky as well, and talk to one of those two and at least start the process and the discussion going, because Macron of France hasn't been able to do it. You know, when you look at the Prime Minister of England, probably not able to do it, and you look at the Chancellor of Germany, probably not able to do it as well. So the problem is they've got themselves in a box, and they're going to have to try to figure their way out of it, because long term, this war cannot last for either side without having a huge war of attrition. And look, the losses they're taking, when you look at the Ukrainian losses, you can't sustain losses like that. The Russians can.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the Russian elite units are just being mauled pretty badly, and their equipment's, they're taking tremendous equipment losses as well. I think both of them are, if I would, make probably a pretty bold comment, I think both of them are looking for a lifeline, for somebody to call. And the trouble is there's nobody to make the call because nobody at the other end to answer. And I think somebody needs to figure that out. Are you going to have this long, involved war that's war that never ends? And the American people are going to get tired of funding it. And we're going into an election year.
Yes.
And this will become one of the national security issues of the debate and the discussion.
Well, you just mentioned the Hill and how challenging it is right now with the Republican side and the continuing resolution and then the impatience. You know, Americans like to see things resolved, and the Ukrainian-Russian attack on Ukraine and security assistance, the amount of money that is being supported for security assistance by the Biden administration takes away from money that could be spent at home. So there is this weariness, and the war of attrition doesn't make it better, and you just mentioned the lifeline is really needed. Since you were there recently, though, and we are providing that security assistance, and you say they're looking for a lifeline, but what's your sense of their determination, their fighting spirit? They seem to have had some successes here recently, especially in the air defense area, sir.
Yeah, I think, look, the tone was set early on. The tone was set in the first week of the war when you had Zelensky. We remember our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, said that Ukraine would fall within 3 days. Remember that?
I do.
It was all public record. And we reached out to Zelensky with the United States and offered him a ride out of town. We basically said, go to Lviv or go somewhere out there. And remember, Zelensky made the comment that, I don't need a ride, what I need is ammunition. Okay, well, a military force will say, okay, I kind of like that guy. You know, we're going to stay and fight with him. And that kind of translated into the fighting spirit of Ukrainians. And my experience going in there is the hatred that the Russians have built up with the Ukrainians is not going to go away. And they're a very capable fighting force. They're good at what they do, and their morale is exceptionally high, and it's fascinating to see, because remember that most of this fighting is on the eastern part of Ukraine. It's got a 600-mile stretch. It's pretty brutal fighting, but the rest of the country has not been, exceptionally damaged by the war. But their attitude is really good. They want to fight. They intend to fight. You know, the males cannot leave Ukraine. Even though one-third of the country is now are refugees, which is stunning. But the males are still there, and they can mobilize. The reason why they haven't continued to mobilize, it's equipment. You know, you can't just bring somebody on and give them a broomstick and say, pretend it's a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to have the equipment and the ability to train them and then put them into the fight. And we've done that to help we, the West, have helped them by moving some of those forces to Britain, are actually into Germany, Grafenwehr, Germany, to train. And they've got, my experience with them is, fundamentally, they're very proud. They're good fighters. They know how to fight, and they think they've at least got a handle on this. I think on the other side, I think the Russians, their main units, the best units they've got, were mauled early in the fight. And now they've gone to a lot of reserve and mobilized forces. And in the big area to the south, with what's called Zaporizhia, where the big fight is going on right now. They've actually had to move some of their elite, the Russians' elite units in there just to stop as much as they can the counteroffensive from the Ukrainians. But that's all going to culminate. What I mean by culminate is this isn't going to, you know, this fight is going to eventually peter out with the winter. It's going to slow down. And then you're going to see another long, endless war continue to go. And that's what I'm saying. Somebody needs to step in and say, okay, enough of this. You know, this nation's lost hundreds of thousands of their finest young men and women. And there's got to be a halt to it somewhere. Just because you halt doesn't mean you have to give up anything. That's when your negotiations begin. And I think they need to look at it that way. They haven't. And I think everybody's pretty stubborn right now, both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, the Ukrainians are pretty clear. They want the Russians to leave. You know, that everything they've occupied since 2014 to include Crimea. And the Russians are saying, no, we're going to keep fighting. And as long as they keep losing forces, they want to hold on to the amount of land that they pick up, even though it's going to be really, really hard for them to do so over the long term. So it's a long answer to a short question, Bob. I just think the fighting resolve and spirit of the Ukrainians is there. They're not demoralized at all. They understand they've got good support from the West. They've got good kit, meaning equipment. And they've got good men and women that are willing to fight.
We've got a few minutes remaining here on your segment, sir, and you provided some important insight as well as really a sense of frustration in terms of what our next steps are going to be, not only just with the Russians, but also with ending this particular war and trying to have a vision. I think it was about a year ago, somebody was looking at the humanitarian costs of all the Ukrainian, the women and children that had to leave Ukraine that got distributed throughout Eastern Europe. A special envoy for humanitarian affairs was considered, I think, to look at the some possible humanitarian approach with the Russians. Now that we've got the UN General Assembly this week, and we've got experts in the United States, and I bring up Condi Rice, obviously a expert on Russia, Soviet Union, President Bush, the Secretary of State. Would a special envoy of that quality with a humanitarian mission be somebody that could be effective, in your view, with an approach to Mr. Putin and also with the Ukrainian president?
Yeah, and UNGA is, UN General Assembly, is coming up. Zelensky will be in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Thursday, and he's going to, I'm sure, going to come out with his, you know, asking for more assistance. I think, honestly, Bob, I think just this is from my position. You've got to solve the fighting issue first, not the humanitarian issue, okay. The humanitarian aid, which is important. But somebody's going to have to finally say, you got to stop killing each other. And that's the important piece they've got to get to. And putting special envoys on the ground has not been successful historically in this conflict in the past. You know, that's the reason you had what's called the Minsk I and Minsk II process, mm-hmm. that both failed. They used special negotiators, try to get them in there, try to solve the problem. You got to stop the killing first, and that's the fighting. Then the humanitarian aid is going to have to pick up after that, even though it's been given. When you look at what's going to have to happen in that country is when you look at certain cities that have been virtually destroyed, like Izium and Mariupol, but you also look at the amount of damage to reoccupy that land alone. You know, the amount of mines that have been distributed on the ground over there it's going to take them 10 years to demine. You know, we're putting mines in, they're putting mines in. You know, kids are being killed and wounded over there from picking mines up. But there's a 600-mile area that is basically going to be sort of like a giant minefield. Mm-hmm. And the humanitarian aid is going to, I think, that it's not going to be so much the food, because Ukrainians can feed themselves. When I was there was, you know, very candidly, Bob, man, you ate well. There was no problem with food.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Not at all. And there's no problem in anything else. And there was no problem on gasoline or any of the staples of life. But the problem is you've got these families that have been displaced. And that's the thing when you talk humanitarian and breaking that also into economic aid, that's what's going to need to be fixed. And the first thing they need to fix is stopping this war. Is and a special negotiator and assistant? Sure. I think you've got people out there who are qualified to do it, but can they actually talk to Putin? Can they actually talk to Zelensky? It's not talking to seconds or thirds. You got to talk to the principals. And until you talk to the principals, look, and I'll give you a quick aside. Example, what we did in the Camp David Accords, when we brought Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat,
yes.
brought them back to Camp David, and basically, you know, fed them, you know, warm beer and cold pizza for 12 days at Camp David, and they came up with the Camp David Accords. At least to stop the fighting for the near term and it actually took Egypt off the fighting level against Israel. And that, you know, my experience in the Middle East, doesn't go to war unless Egypt goes to war with you. And that's something they have to look at and how they have to fix this. But if they don't address the big problem, the big problems of fighting, everything else is just second and secondary and tertiary.
Well, I'll say, General, thank you very much for taking the time today to tell our listeners about Russia and Ukraine and your perspective. I think it was very informative. For all of our listeners out there, there was quite a bit of important geopolitical context that General Kellogg provided us, something to really think about as we go forward in the importance of American foreign policy and our own abilities to help Ukraine and help the fighting to be stopped eventually. So, sir, thank you again for taking the time today to be part of Inside Track. And I also want to recognize you for your service in the United States Army for over three decades, and in particular, your national security service and your continued service and experience in the American media to provide that perspective. So it's great to hear from you again, sir, and thank you again, General Kellogg.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Mr. Producer, let's take a brief time out to pay some bills and make the man happy. When we return, we'll continue our national security Inside Track discussion with a special guest, Mr. John McConnell, former presidential speechwriter for President George W. Bush after 9/11 and throughout his presidency. You're listening to Inside Track on KVOI. Trust the local news and talk. Remember, no station flipping. We'll be right back.
I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
It is the year 2178. Earth is no more. The greatest fears have taken place. An alien ship from the Andromeda Galaxy have discovered the dark planet and sent in a team to unearth what life might have been like.
What have you found? Your Excellency, we found images on a strip of celluloid of what these humans were like. We present this to you.
Quiet.
I see a violent people. No wonder they ceased to exist. What else did you find?
This must have been their mode of transportation. It is what they refer to as an automobile.
Does it function?
We shall show you.
Any information?
There is evidence. It was maintained at Perfection Auto Works, 1046 North Beverly in Tucson, Arizona.
Interesting. Evidence that not everyone of Earth was a stooge.
As long as Earth is still here, have your car maintained at Perfection Auto Works for out-of-this-world service. 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then fail to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Captain Bob is here, and our listeners are tuning into the show. If you have a relevant question or comment for our guests, please call 770-2040, and producer Tom will get you on the air right away. I now have the pleasure of introducing a very special guest joining us now, John McConnell. John served as a longtime senior speechwriter for President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. He was part of a three-person team responsible for all of our 43rd president's major addresses, including the speech to the joint session of Congress after September 11, 2001, and four State of the Union messages. John served all 8 years of the Bush-Cheney administration, holding the unique position of both deputy assistant to the president and assistant to the vice president. So a very good welcome to you, John. Welcome to Inside Track.
Hello from Washington. How are you, Bob?
Hello, John. It's great hearing your voice. Really appreciate you taking the time to be part of Inside Track and to talk to all of our listeners here in this greater Southern Arizona area. And so you are still in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, sir, I am. Still writing speeches for private clients, mostly in the business world, occasionally in politics. And I also do some teaching. I taught a writing course this summer at George Washington University in something called the Graduate School of Political Management.
That's superb. And it's really important for your experience to be translated to the new generation, as well as people that really sometimes appreciate and sometimes don't appreciate the importance of communications, especially from national leadership. And the time I served with you was very special during the time I served in the Bush administration. And you were there a few years before I arrived. I was on my ship in San Diego, and I finally got to serve on the vice president's staff and saw all the different coordination that you had achieved, and also the importance of speech writing and communication for the president. For our listeners, can you please let the audience know and let them in on your efforts crafting those post 9/11 speeches? We're celebrating or recognizing the 9/11 week, the post 9/11 Remembrance Week, and that period of time is still fresh in many people's minds. So that your efforts crafting those post 9/11 speeches, and particularly the State of the Union speech, how did you do it?
Well, it's also very fresh in my mind, as you can imagine. I was in the West Wing of the White House on the morning of 9/11, and was sitting alone with Vice President Cheney. We were watching his television. The first plane had hit the World Trade Center, the North Tower, and as we watched the TV, the second plane appeared on the screen and hit the South Tower. And it was at that moment we realized it was a coordinated terrorist attack. What we didn't realize was that there was a plane coming at us at 500 miles an hour, a plane coming directly toward the White House that ended up hitting the Pentagon. So it was an unforgettable day and an awful experience to live through after the White House was evacuated, and then we started to receive the first reports of how devastating the attack really was in terms of the cost of human lives. My colleagues and I gathered. We couldn't all get together, so we had use of speakerphones as well, but we knew that we were going to be needed to do some presidential remarks for that night. And so we got to work right away on a speech for that evening. As it turned out, the president used a speech mainly written by his counselor, Karen Hughes. A few things that we wrote made it into the speech, but it was really, really her work. But on the 17th was when we got the assignment. That's Monday, the following Monday. When we got the assignment to write the speech for the president to deliver to a joint session of Congress on Thursday, September 20th. And we were also told that the president wanted a draft of the speech that day. And we'd never been given an assignment quite like that. But his position was, if he's going to speak to Congress 3 days from now, he needs to see something. So we got to work pretty fast, as you can imagine. But it's not as if we were lacking for subject matter or material or emotion or anything else. It was all there. in this big event, and everyone wanted to hear what the president had to say. And so we were putting some words on the screen, my colleagues Mike Gerson and Matthew Scully and I, and we worked several hours that day, and then we were called in to see the president. And the president is the one who gave us the idea of arranging the speech according to a series of questions. And if you remember back, the speech had the president saying, "Americans tonight have questions. They want to know who attacked us."
Yes.
And then he explained who it was. They want to know, why do they hate our country? They want to know what is asked of us now. They want to know, how do we fight and win this war? And it was really the president who gave us the idea for organizing it according to those questions. And so by the end of the day, we really did have a speech draft ready. We didn't have a conclusion quite there, but the draft was ready. And then over the next couple of days, we worked with the president in making refinements. And he also did a little practicing of the speech as well. We also had to do a little speech the preceding week, right after 9/11. President spoke to the joint session, National Service of Remembrance at the cathedral in Washington. A short speech, but that's also something that we were given the assignment to work on. And it was a very eventful time, as you can imagine.
I can, and that speech itself needed to communicate to the American people, and it seems like the president, because of his questions and his direction, his sense of urgency to you, really understood the importance of communicating to the American people. And I think in your soul, John, watching you and watching how speeches affect not only the president but also the American people, he seemed to have the pulse of the American people. He seemed to be a leader that by virtue of crafting this particular speech, he knew what he needed to tell the American people. Is that correct?
I always had the feeling that the president, as you say, did have a good sense of where the country was, mm-hmm. and what people wanted to know, and also understood that. He said this to us numerous times over the years I worked for him. I have to explain what we're doing. I have to explain my policy. People need to know what I'm proposing. They need to know what I'm doing, and they need to know why I'm doing it. He was always, if he was after us to make changes in a speech, very often it would be because we hadn't explained things enough. So that was very important to him. George W. Bush wasn't the kind of guy who would make naked assertions without support. It's just he didn't like that in others, and he didn't model that in his own speeches. That I can assure you. I was in my 10th year writing for him when he left office. It started when he was the governor of Texas and during the campaign, and stayed on till the last hour of the last day. And so got used to the way he wanted things, and he wanted explanation and logic in everything he said.
Well, John, we're going to continue the conversation in a few minutes. We have to go to a break right now. So, Mr. Producer, let's take a brief time out to pay some bills and make the man happy. When we return, we'll continue our Inside Track discussion with Mr. John McConnell, former presidential speechwriter for President George W. Bush after 9/11 and throughout his presidency. This is Inside Track.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in, because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up.
With science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
Smooth takeoff. Always thankful for the crew.
You doing okay today?
I had to skip breakfast. A little hungry.
Copy that. I got your back.
Where's he going?
Hi, can I take your order?
Yeah, I'll take two double chubby chucks, two fries, and two double chocolate shakes to go, of course.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Colonel, I'm back.
That was fast, Captain.
Fast food.
All right, the question is, how are you going to get my order to me?
Through the probe and drogue.
But, Captain, that's what they use for refueling.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Thanks, Captain. I got it. It's still warm. Let me tell you, I owe you.
Well, sir, you're invited to the barbecue this weekend and bring a prime rib.
No problem, Captain. I'll see you Sunday, and God bless the USA.
At Perfection Auto Works, we appreciate and honor those that give themselves to protect our freedom. From your F-16 to your F-150, 323-8650, and PerfectionAutoWorks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
We're back with Inside Track and our guest, John McConnell, former presidential speechwriter for President George W. Bush during the Bush administration, all 8 years. Thank you again, listeners, for tuning in. And thank you, John, for your initial discussion about the importance of President Bush's insight to crafting those post-9/11 speeches. As you know from your time in Arizona, education is very important, and you seem with your George Washington University time to look at the future and to make sure the next generation has the benefit of your experience. And we have listeners from our great Arizona universities, including University of Arizona, Pima College, here in the general broader Tucson area, even out toward Phoenix and Sierra Vista. For those college students who are desiring to go into government communications and even speech writing at any level, what can you tell them?
Well, the best advice I can give as a speechwriter is, if that's something you want to do, work hard at writing. Write whenever you can. Take writing courses from good professors, and just remember that this is a tool you can sharpen. I took writing courses, of course, but I didn't take any speech writing courses. There weren't really such a thing when I was in college or law school, but I wrote all the time and I listened to speeches. From the time I was a kid, I was interested in politics, and I listened to political speeches, and that's really how I learned about how speeches are written, is by listening to them, reading them, watching them on television, and wanting to know why this speech worked. Why was this particular speech effective? Why was this speech not effective? As I say, I didn't get any real guidance on it, but just we all know when something is good when we hear it. And it was an excellent way of learning how to write speeches. My first job in speech writing was for Vice President Dan Quayle at the White House in 1990. And I got hired. I had never been a professional speechwriter before, but I had good recommendations, and I was available when they needed me, mm-hmm. and I was willing to work for very little money.
And that's how I got in the door. And so that's the final way that I learned how to do speeches, and that is by simply writing them and getting better at it over time. And Jeff, Bob, I can add one more thing. Another key to becoming a good writer is reading a lot. Read good writing. That's another way to sharpen your tool. The more of it you see, the better sense you get of what is involved in good writing. And so that's another recommendation I made. Doesn't matter what you read, as long as it's good.
Well, I'm teaching graduates at the University of Arizona in national security, and your comments really warm my heart with regard to the emphasis for the students to improve themselves. And to, I really like how you put it, John, the tool that you can sharpen with good writing, reading good writers to basically improve your communication skills. And this particular generation is different than the generation, obviously, that I grew up with, and certainly the 22 years ago with 9/11, social media has impacted their lives, and it's all, certainly digital. But what you're saying, though, is to go the extra step, is to find that professor, find those books that can really help you sharpen your skills and be a better writer. That writer skill really does help their critical thinking and allows them to communicate. And if they do go into these political or government positions, learning from a leader like yourself about presidential speechwriter, the importance of presidential communications, that's important.
Well, you remember when you and I worked together at the White House, when it was time for a speech to be written for the president or the vice president, the speech would be written, but that wasn't the end of the process.
Oh, no.
Of course, it had to be fact-checked. It had to be gone over. And it also had to be refined. That's another important thing about writing that I constantly put across to students and others, is that the key to good writing is rewriting, looking at it again and again and again. And if it's a speech, also very important to read it aloud, because you might think you know how it sounds, but you don't until you hear it. And you'll always catch things in the reading. A word is hard to say. It's not a good speech word. Or there's three words in a row that begin with the same letter, and it sounds a little funny when you read it aloud. Those are just examples of why it's important to read a written material, or a written speech, read it aloud before you turn it in. It's generally true in everything we do. You check your work, you go over it again. You don't just sit back and be satisfied at the first thing that comes to your mind, then you put down on paper. Think about it, spend time. It always pays off.
Yes, and our time is short, but we still have an opportunity to really reflect back on that 9/11 period of time and what President Bush did to communicate to the nation and actually mobilize the nation. Did his State of the Union or his post 9/11 joint session of Congress speech occur before or after he went to the 9/11 site? If you remember that time frame. John.
Yeah, it was after. He spoke at the National Cathedral on Friday morning, September 14th, and then he went from there to Ground Zero, and that's where they gave him the bullhorn. And the speech to Congress was the following week, Thursday the 20th.
I actually met at the Tucson Book Show one of the firemen that yelled the question to President Bush, where he had to respond, I can't hear you. Back in his particular area, but what did President Bush tell the nation from that particular area with that fireman, John?
Yeah, he was saying a few words, and these guys started shouting, "We can't hear you!" And the president said, "I can hear you!" And that's when they erupted in cheers and applause. And he said, "I hear you. The world hears you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon." And a signature line of his presidency, and it's humbling for the speechwriters to be reminded that he had nothing to do with it.
In summary, in this very busy world then, reflecting back on 9/11, just summarize, if you could. You mentioned President Bush. I have to explain the policy that we're embarking on, the logic behind it to the American people. Is there anything else that President Bush conveyed to you with the importance of communicating to the American people, communicating to the people that elected him and also that government by the people? What's the importance of the president's speech based on President Bush's perspective?
Well, you know, it was a serious moment in our history, and it was the beginning of a long struggle. And one point that I remember him making to us at the time was, there might be some people who get tired of hearing about this this war against terror, but that's too bad. He's going to keep talking about it, and he sure did keep his word on that. He never veered from the task. He knew what his responsibilities were, and he wanted the country to know that he was on the case. And if there were people in the media or elsewhere who got tired of hearing it, that was quite beside the point. He was going to do his job and protect the country.
He said, yes, sir.
Sure kept that.
I still remember that. We were not going to take another hit. And basically, even with Vice President Cheney, we make sure that we were not complacent, that we want to continue to communicate to the American people to avoid the complacency. The threat was still there.
That's right. We got hit first, and it was the start of a war.
Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today here on Inside Track. And I think you've conveyed to the audience during this very important week of remembrance that time, that very critical, tragic time where we lost over 3,000 people. And as you mentioned, a plane was even coming at the White House and where you were with Vice President Cheney. And the entire period of time during that 10 days after 9/11 happened, where the president was standing before the joint session of Congress. So with that, I really appreciate it. This is going to do it for our time together during the first hour of Inside Track. So thank you again, John McConnell.
Thanks, Bob. It was an honor to be part of it. I appreciate your having me on the show, and it was an honor working with you at the White House, too.
Well, thank you, John. And for our listeners out there, we hope you learned something from our chats today with General Keith Kellogg and John McConnell. Thank you, Inside Track listeners, and stand by for hour number two. You won't want to miss it.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists, but I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrap yard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Perfection Theater presents Snow White.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who has the sweetest ride of them all?
It once was you, but Snow White has a Maserati that's now the fairest and the fastest.
I will put an end to that.
The Evil Queen drove over to Snow White's cottage in her Ferrari F40.
I will finish her off once and for all.
The Evil Queen poured apple cider vinegar in her gas tank.
Can you dwarves help me? I need a push to Perfection Auto Works.
The Perfection mechanics cleaned the fuel lines, and Snow White was back on the road in no time. Snow White had enough, so she headed to the Evil Queen's castle.
Pour apple cider vinegar in my gas tank. Why, I'll show you.
And the moral of the story, Perfection Auto Works is always there to make your automotive repairs come true. 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.